Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the Metabolic Classroom, a nutrition and lifestyle podcast focused on the truth behind why we get sick and fat. What you're about to hear was taken from a live broadcast streamed on insuliniq.com.
Good day, everybody who is joining me today for the Metabolic Classroom. The discussion that we have today is continuing, and indeed it's the final part of our discussion about insulin resistance. To this point in the previous episodes, which you definitely need to listen to or watch if you haven't yet, we introduced this topic, and you are now more familiar, having watched them or listened to them, on what insulin resistance is and where it comes from and why it matters, namely all of the diseases that it contributes to. And we did a kind of overview of some of the big ones. And then, as sobering as all of that is, we end with a bit of a happy ending, which is today's discussion on what to do about it. So as much as we've been discussing the problems with insulin resistance, the scope, the prevalence and relevance, if you will, now it really is the resolution, which is comforting, because it is something that is so solvable or even so preventable. Now, so the focus of today's class is really how to fix insulin resistance. But before I discussed that, I thought I would take a few minutes to share with you ways that you could just know where you're at with regards to your insulin resistance. Just a generally kind of helpful overview, where you may be listening to this and not know your own insulin resistance or the insulin resistance state of the loved one that you have in mind as you've been listening to these discussions. So firstly, let me just revisit a topic that we discussed earlier, namely the problem with the traditional view of insulin resistance. The traditional view of insulin resistance is very glucose-centric. Because we have assigned the hormone insulin to having no more relevance than diabetes, we purely look at it through the lens of glucose. And so most conventional clinical tests that are attempting or speculating on the nature of insulin resistance or prediabetes, which is the same thing, are only looking at the glucose. The problem with that view is that, remember, insulin's most famous job, but not its most important. Insulin does all kinds of important things, and many critical things. Insulin's most famous effect is to correct what is a steady increase in insulin, glucose. So if glucose is going up, insulin will sense this, it will be mobilized, it will come up, and then open the doors of cells throughout the body, allowing the glucose to come down, which then allows the insulin to come back down. But they're not the same thing. Glucose is not insulin. Insulin is not glucose. That seems very obvious. But even still, there's this weird inability to disconnect the two ideas, where it's important for you to remember that insulin resistance is a state where insulin is elevated. That says nothing about the glucose. We don't know what the glucose is. In fact, glucose can be normal. And therein lies the rub. That's the problem, right? If we have a glucose-centric paradigm of insulin resistance, it's possible that the individual that we may be moving through the years, getting an annual blood test, and we are measuring only ever our glucose, and the glucose is staying normal. All the while, insulin is getting higher and higher and higher, working harder and harder in an effort to keep the glucose in check. But it is doing it. And then it's only once the body becomes so resistant to its insulin that even though insulin is still multiples higher than it should be, now the glucose starts to climb, and now we detect the problem 10 or even 20 years after the insulin had already been fighting. So insulin is the more sensitive signal. It's the canary in the coal mine, if you will. It gives us the earlier warning. Now, that brings us back to measuring what are the actual tests now that we can measure to determine your insulin resistance state. One of them is fasting insulin. Insulin is a marker of insulin resistance. Ideally, that number is less than 6 in a fasted state. So if you're doing a 12-ish hour fast, you would love for that number to be 6 microunits per mil. I'm, of course, in the U.S., so I'm giving U.S. units. You can convert to picomoles as needed. And I believe the conversion would be around 30-ish or high 20s, maybe 27 picomole for those outside the U.S. So 6 microunits per mil. Now, however, what if it's a little higher than that? What if it is up to the mid-teens, for example? So I kind of have this other cutoff, which is a little, you can be a little loose with this. But if someone has a fasted insulin between, say, 7 to 17 or so, that doesn't necessarily mean they're insulin resistant. Now, why, do you ask? Elevated insulin is a sign of insulin resistance. It's because insulin has a rhythm to it, like so many hormones do. Not all hormones, but many. Insulin will ebb and it'll flow throughout the day. And it's entirely possible that you get your insulin, your blood drawn at a moment when insulin was starting to climb up a little bit. For example, insulin will climb in the morning, and then it may do so again in the mid-afternoon, just as a even in a purely fasted state. It's just part of its rhythm. Now, that I mentioned that second kind of category. If insulin is 6 or below, that's a really good sign that you're insulin sensitive. If it's in that intermediate realm, 7 to 17, that suggests there's a problem, but not absolute. And then if it's high teens, 18 and above, it's very likely that you are, in fact, insulin resistant and you've detected a true problem there. Now, what if it is in that middle range? In fact, even if it isn't, we don't need to stop with just fasting insulin. Insulin is volatile. It changes. So are there markers that are a little more stable? There are, albeit now we get into the realm of a little indirect with this one. But it is surprisingly accurate. And that is the triglyceride to HDL ratio. The triglyceride divided by HDL number. So you take your fasted triglycerides, which you get at every blood test. That's the benefit of this. It's not common to get insulin measured at a blood test, whereas we always will get our lipids measured. So you look at your blood test and you see your triglycerides, and then you divide triglycerides by the HDL number, and you always get HDL cholesterol. That will give you this ratio. And if it is less than 1.5, that's a really good sign. If it's above 1.5, that starts to get into the realm of being troublesome. It's a little problematic. So you'd want to be a little more cautious and assume that you have some degree of insulin resistance. So that's the triglyceride to HDL ratio. Now, the last test that I want to mention, remember, and we're all just kind of framing the conversation of how to fix insulin resistance. But again, my purpose in having this bit of a prequel tangent is to help you understand where you're at. The last one is my favorite one, which is called the Adipo-IR score. Adipo, just for adipose. So it's the adipose insulin resistance score. This is a test that is looking at the insulin resistance at the fat cells. Now, why does that matter? Do you recall from our earlier conversation of the tissue that I said likely starts insulin resistance throughout the body. When you have this progressive and steady insulin resistance that's creeping into the person's life throughout the years, I submit that it's the fat tissue that becomes insulin resistant first. And thus, if you have a way of determining insulin resistance at the fat tissue, then you are detecting it potentially at its earliest possible stages. That's what the adipose insulin resistance score will tell us. Now, something that's so interesting about this is just the elegance of the biochemistry of what's happening at the fat cell, or the biology of the fat cell. Now, we know that the fat cells house this big droplet, I mean, relatively big, microscopically big, but big by cell standards, a big bubble of fat, if you will. And insulin is largely the signal, not the only one, but is a primary signal that's influencing the growing or the shrinking of that, what's called a lipid droplet, that big bubble of fat within the fat cell. If insulin is elevated, it is preventing the fat cell from breaking down its fat through a process called lipolysis. Insulin inhibits lipolysis. Now, the product of lipolysis, or the evidence of lipolysis in the blood, is something called free fatty acids, also sometimes referred to as non-esterified fatty acids. They're the same thing. FFAs or NEFAs, it's the same. I'm just going to call them free fatty acids to cut out a couple syllables for the sake of the discussion. So if insulin is elevated, free fatty acids should be down because insulin is inhibiting lipolysis. In contrast, if insulin is down through, say, a fasted state or low-carb diet, then you'd expect free fatty acids to be higher because insulin is not present to inhibit lipolysis. And that's indeed what you'd get. So high insulin should be leading to reduced free fatty acids. Low insulin would lead to elevated free fatty acids. That's what this test is attempting to determine. The two parts of this formula is fasted insulin and fasted free fatty acids. Now, measuring free fatty acids is not common. It can be done, but it is not a common test. So you'd have to either go in and pay for it directly at LabCorp or Quest or something, or convince your clinician to check that box and hope your insurance will cover it. But it's a fascinating test. One of the reasons I'm so fascinated in it is its sensitivity of actually indicating metabolic problems. Now, I'm going to come back. I'm not done with this, but as an example, one of the very first papers I ever saw that used this study was looking at the degree of insulin resistance in otherwise healthy women who had PCOS. So they had women with and without polycystic ovary syndrome, the most common infertility, and it's metabolic. Go to the previous lecture, Metabolic Classroom, and listen for more details on that. We talked about it in more detail. So two groups of ladies controlled for age and even body weight and body fat. So they were the same overall body type. And in the women with PCOS in this particular study, they did not see signs of whole body insulin resistance. But when they looked at the fasted insulin in combination with the fasted free fatty acids, then, or in other words, the ADIPO-IR score, they detected a significant increase in these women with PCOS. So the insulin resistance wasn't even manifesting at the level of the whole body, but it was evident at the level of the first tissue that becomes insulin resistant, namely the fat tissue. So if you've gotten those numbers, fasted insulin in microunits per mil, and the units are important here. So microunits per mil, and you multiply that number, fasted insulin in microunits per mil times free fatty acids in millimole. Now, thankfully, that's going to be millimole anywhere in the world. So that's going to be a pretty consistent unit. And you want that number to be below a certain cutoff, but it's different for men and women. Now, another little tangent here to explain why. At any given moment, women will have a free fatty acid level in her blood that can be up to 40 or even 50% higher than it is in a man. So if a man is manifesting with a free fatty acid of 1 millimolar, his healthy female counterpart is very likely going to be 1.5 millimolar free fatty acids. Women are constantly mobilizing fat from her fat cells much more than her male counterparts. And that's entirely a product of sex hormones, particularly the estradiols. estrogens, estradiol being the main one, the estrogens. Estrogens are promoting this higher rate of turnover of the fat cells. So at any moment, there's more fat coming out of the fat cell. And indeed, at any moment, a female is burning more fat. This will be the topic of another, of a future metabolic classroom. But suffice it to say, women are fat burning machines relative to her male counterparts. Now, of course, the woman is rolling her eyes thinking, well, why do I have more fat? Because you're also putting more in to those fat cells, but again, you're taking more out. So that's what I meant by the higher turnover, more going in, but more coming out. And that's evidenced as the higher free fatty acids. So what are the cutoffs? In a man, that ApoIR score is ideally less than 5. If his ApoIR score is less than 5, that suggests that his fat tissue is insulin sensitive. In a woman, that cutoff is 8. It's higher. She has a little more room there because her free fatty acids are naturally higher. Men and women will have generally similar levels of insulin, but when it comes to free fatty acids, no, not similar. Females will be higher because they're fat-burning machines because of the estrogens, and so her ApoIR score has to account for that, and thus the cutoff is higher. So women, if it's less than 8, thumbs up. Your fat tissue is insulin sensitive. Men, if it's less than 5, thumbs up. High five. You're doing well. Okay. So those are some tests. Maybe a final one, if you don't want to wait for getting any kind of blood draw, because all of these are dependent on a blood draw and maybe you don't have access to that or you don't have the data on hand. There's a bit of a quick and dirty way as well, but emphasis on dirty because it's going to be very, very indirect. But one is simply, do you have high blood pressure? If you have high blood pressure, it's very likely you have insulin resistance. I know that's a very kind of dramatic statement for what's a fairly common problem, but it really holds true. Or you can do some circumference measurements. Measure the biggest part around your belly. And if you multiply that number by 2, and if that number is higher than your height, that's a problem. Let me say that again in a slightly different way. Measure your height. Then measure your waist circumference times 2. If your waist circumference times 2 is a bigger number than your height, that suggests you're storing fat in an unhealthy way and it would likely be contributing to insulin resistance. If your height is a bigger number than your waist circumference times 2, that suggests that you're likely doing fine. All right, now let's really dive into the solutions here. Firstly, let me just remind you of the 3 primary causes of insulin resistance: stress, inflammation, and hyperinsulinemia. When I introduced those 3 in an earlier classroom, I emphasized how the problem with stress and inflammation is that it can be difficult to change those numbers because you don't know what's causing them. Let's say you measured your epinephrine or adrenaline or your cortisol as stress hormone markers, and you had a marker of inflammation like C-reactive protein and it was high. You might not necessarily know how to lower them. It's not clear what's contributing to them. So just for the sake of time,
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Not going to spend too much time on those. Other than perhaps to say, when it comes to stress, very, very often poor sleep is going to be the main aggravator. If it's not sleep, then it's likely going to be excessive caffeine consumption, which can increase your epinephrine or adrenaline numbers. So perhaps a reason to focus on sleep, and better sleep habits, and be mindful of your caffeine consumption. All right, now the elevated insulin. This is the one to focus on because it can yield such immediate results. Now, in talking about the elevated insulin, I wanted to frame this in a bit of a metaphor, where if we think of an insulin sensitizing lifestyle change, we can think of it as a journey. And a lot, as we stand at the beginning of this journey, with the end result being, I want to reduce my insulin, or to say that another way, the end result being, I want to shrink my fat cells. Because remember, progressive pathogenic insulin resistance is usually starting at the fat cell because the fat cells are growing too big. They're undergoing hypertrophy. So the solution then, simple in concept, if not practice, is to shrink those fat cells. So there we are at the beginning of this fat cell shrinking journey. We have 2 feet. We can take one of two steps first. Each of these steps could be reflected in two different ideas, namely calories and insulin. The traditional view of improving insulin sensitivity through shrinking fat cells or weight loss is the caloric view, namely eat less, exercise more. So that's the first step that most people take with no regard on insulin. But let's say the person is going into this journey with elevated insulin, as virtually all of them would be. And if you take a first step where reducing the calories coming in is the first step and insulin is not dropping quickly, that creates a bit of an energetic crisis for the following reasons. If less energy is coming in and insulin is still elevated, then insulin is pushing whatever energy is available in your blood out of your blood, pushing it to be stored in tissues throughout the body, like fat tissue, like muscle tissue, like liver, etc. All of these tissues that are now being told to store the energy. Unfortunately, the brain doesn't store energy. It really needs to rely almost constantly on any energy that's being provided from the blood. What are the calories in the blood that can feed the brain? And if less calories are coming in, but insulin is a little sticky and it's staying elevated because you're just dropping your fat consumption to lower calories, but you're still eating plenty of carbs because they're lower calorie, which is what everybody does on a low calorie diet. It's always cut the fat, which won't affect insulin at all, and focus on the carbs, which will increase insulin. So they are restricting calories coming in, but in the presence of high insulin, the limited calories that are available in the blood are being pushed into cells. And so the brain, who must constantly rely on the blood for its energy, is looking at the reduced energy in the blood and it panics. And it starts to tell the body, you need to eat. In other words, it stimulates hunger. Now, let me just in the midst of this metaphor of a fat cell shrinking journey and which step is first, let me introduce another metaphor. So we're going one level deeper, or just an example here. Let's imagine that I am inviting all of you listening to a dinner. We're going to meet and we are going to be fed by the world's most famous chefs preparing the most delicious foods. And as I'm inviting you to this dinner, I want you to be able to try all of it. And so I say to one and all, come hungry, because you're going to want to eat some of everything. What would you do to come as hungry as possible to this grand and beautiful buffet? I submit you do two things. In the days before this beautiful buffet, you would eat a little less and you would exercise a little more. And it would work. You would come hungry. Eating a little less, exercising a little more would be the perfect recipe to come to my grand buffet as hungry as possible. But do you see the problem? That's also the two pillars. That's the two pillars of strategy that has existed since for 50 or 60 years on how to lose weight or how to shrink fat cells. Every professional will tell this person who's trying to shrink their fat cells, you need to eat less and exercise more. The problem is because the consequence will be the same thing as would happen in the example I'm presenting, which is you coming and meeting me to eat as much as we can. You're going to be as hungry as possible. It's going to stimulate ever more hunger, and thus you will fail. Last part of that, how many times have you guys seen a reunion tour for the contestants on that morbid game show, The Biggest Loser? You don't. these people don't, they don't put them back on screen. You don't see them again because they gain it all back. That can be a topic for another time. The metabolic consequences of the severe restriction that they go through actually have lasting effects, and they're negative. Unfortunately, there are negative consequences to that. So back to the fat cell shrinking journey. If the first step is immediately pushing down the calories without addressing the insulin, it's going to be a very short journey. You'll get a little down the road. You'll lose some weight, shrink some fat cells, but inevitably you're going to find yourselves back at the beginning and maybe even 10 yards further back than you were at the start. So keep that foot firmly planted. Don't worry about calories. Let the first step be, I'm going to lower my insulin. Now, if you lower insulin, why don't you have to focus on calories? You have some adaptations that begin to occur. As insulin comes down, your body is now a little looser with all of its stored energy. It is now, in fact, mobilizing more energy to be burned. So the brain has an abundance of energy. It has sufficient glucose because the liver is providing everything else that you're not getting from your diet. And now all of a sudden it has access to all of these beautiful ketones. Remember, ketones are simply products of fat burning. And if insulin, the very first metabolic classroom in this sort of re-released version, we spoke about metabolic flexibility and how it's insulin that dictates whether your body is sugar burning or fat burning. If insulin is low and you're fat burning, you may get to a point where you're burning so much fat that you start creating ketones from that fat. And again, the brain loves ketones. If the brain has any preferred fuel, it is in fact ketones, not glucose. So we have this state where the brain is very adequately fed, no panic signal, no signal to try to increase the energy of the blood, and thus reduced sense of hunger. So the person has greater satiety. But at the same time, when insulin is down, you not only are, you have an elevated metabolic rate. So low insulin means higher metabolic rate. Insulin suppresses the metabolic rate. It wants to reduce the idle of your metabolic engine. So when insulin is down, the engine just starts revving up a bit. It's like you're starting to press the metabolic accelerator of that metabolic engine. So that's one. And then the final part of it is when you start creating ketones, remember ketones have a caloric value. And you start excreting them from your breath and from your urine. So every breath as you're breathing out ketones, every urination when you're urinating out ketones, those are caloric molecules that would have otherwise had to be burned or stored. Not anymore. Now you're just wasting energy, which is good if you're trying to shrink fat cells that are overfilled with energy. Now, how can you lower insulin? If that is the step you want to take, that's a little easier said than done. You've heard me give these three pillars before. And they're always worth emphasizing, if for no other reason than they just roll off the tongue so well. First, control carbs. This is, I put it first because I deem it the most important. You want to make sure you're, whatever carbs you're getting, that you're focusing on sources that are not coming from bags and boxes with barcodes. Whole fruits and vegetables, eat them, don't drink them, are generally going to all be good. There's different levels we could go with, different depths and defining that a little more clearly depending on the beginning, but just at its simplest form, just control carbs, eat fruits and vegetables and enjoy them liberally. Next, prioritize protein. Make sure you're getting abundant, high quality, which means preferably animal source protein every day. Third, don't fear fat. In particular, don't fear the fat that comes with the protein. In nature, there is no exception to this. Every protein comes with fat. Don't be afraid of it. I understand we have a fat phobic culture now. You need to reject it. Fat is not only essential, we need it. There are some fats that are necessary for human survival, but they also have no effect on blood sugar or blood insulin. So it's a nice, nourishing option. You have to get over the fear of fat, especially the fat that comes with protein. So those are the three steps: control carbs, prioritize protein, don't fear fat. That will really help you lower insulin. So that is that insulin step that really moves you down the journey very, very far. Indeed, that step alone, only focusing on lowering insulin, never worrying about calories, may be sufficient for anyone listening to shrink their fat cells as much as they need to and as much as they want to. In some people, they may plateau a little earlier than they'd like by focusing only on the insulin. They'll get some benefit, indeed maybe a lot, but they know they got a little further to go. Now you are ready to take that other step, that other foot that's been so firmly planted, and you just had one really big step that got you farther down the road with the insulin lowering, now you can take that next step, which is addressing the energy explicitly. Usually the energy corrects itself for reasons I mentioned earlier, that when insulin's low, your body's using its own stored energy. All of those energy bars, if you will, that you've had stashed away in your fat cells are finally being opened up to be used, which is what they're there for. So sometimes people will begin restricting they'll have greater satiety and start eating less just on their own without even doing it deliberately. Indeed, that is what usually happens. But if you need to, now you can explicitly address the energy part of it, but don't do so by counting calories. Do so rather by structured fasting. So that's that fourth part of the three parts I gave earlier. The fourth could be frequently fasting. And that can take any form. We'll have more discussion in the future about specific versions of fasts, but suffice it to say, a period of structured fasting and then eating can be a very, very good way to overall restrict energy in a healthy way. Now, one comment on that, though, is that fat with fasting, how you end a fast is more important than how long you fast. So the temptation is to obsess over a 48-hour fast or something like that, and then you get so hungry that you just binge, and then you stuff yourself full of food that came from likely bags and boxes with barcodes, and you feel miserable mentally and physically. And that basically leads into a disordered eating pattern of almost kind of a binge purge cycle. You don't want that. So how you end your fast matters more than how long you fast. Have a very specific meal plan in mind for when you are ending your fast. Now, let's talk a little bit about exercise to kind of wrap it up. Exercise is very important at improving insulin sensitivity. One primary reason for this is it really lowers insulin. When you exercise, insulin is antithetical to what the body's trying to do metabolically. When you're exercising, you want to be moving or mobilizing and burning energy. Insulin abhors mobilizing and burning energy. It only wants to store energy. And thus, it's no surprise as the body starts to demand exercise, insulin will retreat into the background, knowing that it's not its turn to be active. The body needs to use the energy, insulin retreats, and so it will lower insulin. Also, remember the main stimulus for insulin is elevated blood glucose. And the nice thing about exercise is that muscle is the main consumer of glucose. So muscle is, in other words, the most hungry tissue, that up to 80% of the clearance of glucose from the blood after a meal is glucose that's going into the muscle. So the muscle eats the lion's share of glucose from the blood. And so when you're exercising, the muscles are eating a lot of it, and that lasts for several hours after exercise. And then if you happen to be engaging beyond the acute benefit over a day or so of improving insulin sensitivity with exercise, if you are increasing your muscle mass, now, at any given moment, you have more of these mouths to feed, and the muscle will greedily pull in and use glucose every time you're moving them. And the nice thing is, when you move the muscle, it doesn't need to rely on insulin to eat the glucose. In a rested state, if you're sitting down now, any glucose that would be going into your muscles would be doing so because insulin comes and knocks on the door, most especially if you're listening to this in a postprandial state or a state after you just ate. Then insulin goes up, it then knocks on the door of the muscle cells in particular and a few others, and opens those doors to allow the glucose to come in. When you're exercising, remember, insulin cannot tolerate that. It can't be elevated. But the muscle is so hungry that it has an insulin-independent mechanism. In other words, it can open those glucose doors without needing to wait for insulin to come and knock. There is, if you will, a back door. Exercise opens the back door, allowing the glucose to come in through an unconventional route, thereby helping lower blood glucose, which helps lower insulin in the long term, which then improves insulin sensitivity directly and by shrinking fat cells. Now, with that in mind, you may be thinking, well, then, Ben, what's the most important or best exercise I can do? My answer, and I hope it's not too pithy, is the one you'll do. Whatever you can do to just get out and be mobile, that's what you should stick with. Now, if you have options and sufficient motivation, My strong recommendation is resistance training over endurance training. Endurance training is not going to do too much to help maintain muscle mass. Indeed, it may start to work against you maintaining muscle mass. You want resistance training as much as you can. Anything you can do to fatigue your muscles, even something as simple as push-ups and chair squats until you start to feel a little bit of burn, and do that just a few times a day, is going to be, depending on where you're at, is going to be a stimulus to help you increase your muscle mass. And remember, more muscle means greater insulin sensitivity, usually. Now, the great big elephant in the room on ways to improve insulin sensitivity are drugs. But here you're going to be disappointed, because that's the topic starting next month. That's going to be February's metabolic classrooms, all about the cardiometabolic drugs and the options from. And we're going to go across a few different cardiometabolic complications, including weight loss, including diabetes, and a handful of others, high blood pressure. And we're going to just look at the generally do a bit of an overview, but also focus a little directly on the cardiometabolic ones.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.